conferencing and telecommunications capability in light of our current circumstances. So there's been renewed interest in maybe developing a homepage for the Denver Sangha. And so that's definitely something that's come to the front burner. And those that might have an interest in participating and doing that, you can drop me an e-note through either me or Kathleen, and we'll put together a little working group that would like to participate in that process in terms of what we might want to look like, what are some of the functions we'd like for it to be able to perform. I've been having some interesting discussions with David Chernikoff, and in addition to things that we're doing at the individual Sangha level, David has some really interesting ideas that we've kind of kicked around a little bit and that I've contributed to, with ways that we might, as a statewide Sangha under the umbrella of the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado, be of greater service to each other as well. And so one of the ideas that David had was to, as soon as we can get it set up, to for all the Sanghas to co-host a Monday morning, a daily morning sit every day at 8 a.m. And it would run for just about a half an hour, and there wouldn't be talks or anything to speak of. It's just a sitting opportunity. And so people would log on, and one of the teachers in the IMCC teaching community would be leading each one of the sets. And then as this process gets regularized, any of the members of the Denver Teaching Collective that might wish to provide that service as well will be able to do so. So it's just going to be an every morning sitting opportunity for anyone that might want to participate. And as soon as we get the particulars worked out, then you'll be getting notice about that on the listserv. The other thing that we talked about doing was to establish a variety of thematic interest groups across all the Sanghas. So for instance, one of the things that David has been thinking about doing is starting up a cluster of Kalyanamita or spiritual friends groups, and those would be administered in somewhat the same way that they have been in the past and in his Sangha anyway, and also as we've done it occasionally in the past, which is that the group would have a beginning and a middle and an end. It would last for about 8 weeks, and people would be invited to register, and then once the group got to be a certain size, then another group would be opened up until everyone who would like to participate in that could do so. So that's one thing. And then another, in addition to these kind of registration closed groups, is to have other groups that are open enrollment in nature that would be organized around specific themes or specific dynamics. So for instance, perhaps having age-specific groups, because the challenges facing people in different age groups are a little bit different based on how the coronavirus is operating. One of the things, sadly, that's becoming sort of apparent is that people who are in recovery programs, when they cannot meet in person, which, you know, mutual reinforcement and support is really, really important in that realm of Sangha development. So maybe we could have an online group specifically oriented around issues of recovery and how to maintain recovery going forward. One of the things that I'll be talking a little bit more about in my talk and that we can certainly discuss is the use of language. I think there's a growing awareness that the choice of the term social distancing is not really serving us all that well, because it implies social isolation. And in fact, that social isolation is very dangerous. It's dangerous both mentally and physically. So while we're moving into this new way of living our lives together, physical distancing is obviously going to be very important, but social contact and social cohesion and increased social networking is extremely important. And so we're looking to, you know, put together communities of interest to support each other across these dimensions, whether it's recovery programs, age-specific programs, perhaps people who've just lost their employment. You know, there's a common set of threats that arise for them, and how to help each other work our way through that. For an awful lot of people out there, there is much less concern or fear about succumbing to the virus than there is having their lives radically disrupted around issues like employment and housing and just meeting, you know, basic needs. And so what we want to do, and others in the Sangha may have ideas for specific groups as well, support groups. And so the idea is to find out where those areas of interest lie within the sanghas, and then putting together groups around them to the extent that they're meeting a felt need. So that's something that we'll be putting more information out about as well. But also, I really invite people in the sangha, if you have ideas for other kinds of groups that might want to start organizing, then definitely that's something we'd like to look at, just as well as other ways we might use networking software to maintain our cohesion and our mutual support going forward. So any questions about any of those thoughts so far? Okay. Can everyone, Kathleen, can everyone participate who wishes to in terms of speaking now?
Lloyd?
Yeah.
This is Kathy again. And
yes,
one of the things that I would love to see is that we, even after we're allowed to actually be in the same place with each other, maintain some of these technological things for people who are at some distance from where we regularly meet. I think it will provide some opportunities for people to continue to get together on a more frequent basis when you take the travel element out of it.
I totally agree. I think this is going to have a transformative effect on how we work together. And the other thing we're going to be doing, of course, is trying to make sure that anybody in any of the sanghas who would like to join a sitting and hear a Dharma talk from any of us can do so. So every once in a while, I know people would go up to Boulder to hear David teach, or David would come down here. And now all of that can be done electronically. So anybody from any of the sanghas who wishes to can just log on and sit and hear a Dharma talk and participate in the discussion. So in some ways, I see it, you know, we've been geographically distanced for all these years, but this is going to be an interesting way, I think, of creating connections across the sanghas that hasn't really existed in the past. And I think that you're right. Once we figure out how to do this, we'd like to make sure that that remains available. So essentially, that just means there's going to be more Dharma available over the long haul, I think. So, yeah, point well taken.
Lloyd?
Here I am.
This is Sharon.
And yes.
I've kind of been a member of the Sangha for the last 22 years, but...
Right, okay.
Too sick to sit with you. So this is the only time I've had spiritual community.
Wow.
And I would really like it to continue.
Absolutely. I can clearly hear that. And I think we're going to make every effort to ensure that it does. Yeah.
And I can contribute something financially. I know it costs, but it would mean the world to me. This is the first week I've had any spiritual community to sit with, other than my dear Kathleen and Barbara, who have come to my house for 10 years to meditate.
Good. It's really gratifying and heartwarming for me to hear you say that, and I think it just it reaffirms the need for us to, once we've established these online networks, to keep them going. Thanks so much. I appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Well, I know some of you have done the five recollections practice before. It may be new to some, and I'm wondering if anyone has any reactions or thoughts that they'd like to share about what it was to do this practice this evening, whether it's with regard to any one particular of the recollections or the distinction between when you say I am of a nature to die rather than we are of a nature to die, if you notice any differences in there. So anyone that would like to share, this is a good time for that.
I have a question.
Yeah, Tony?
So I heard you saying there the part about my actions wholesome or unwholesome, and I was just wondering what that the wording at the end, I couldn't understand if you were saying error is the last word, but what was that one again?
Yeah. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I shall become the heir. Heir, the English word H-E-I-R.
Okay.
Meaning I shall inherit.
Okay.
Right. It's the whole thing, you know, the image that the Buddha frequently used in talking about karma was, you know, the action is like the genetic code of the fruit that drops off the tree and then gives birth to the next tree. And it's like whatever our previous actions were basically give in the past, give birth to whoever we're going to be in the future. And so that's why trying to be doing whatever we can in the moment to clean up our act and try to act in ways that are beneficial to ourselves and others are going to be likely to result in us being happier and more at peace in the future. Yeah, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Anything else? Okay. Well, so here's some thoughts that I'd like to share.
I think there were some.
Sure.
We is a very important part to bring into this, because really we are all in this together. Our certainty about our health, about our life or death, is everybody. All of us have this. When we come to financial stuff, all of us have some uncertainty about where's the money going to come for the rent or the or whatever. We are all in this together.
In fact, that's exactly the way the Buddha taught it. What he did was to, when he offered the teaching, first he went through it just as we did the first time, where he said, consider for yourself, you know, whether or not you're going to age, whether or not you're going to be subject to getting sick, whether or not you're going to die, and how it makes you feel when you reflect on those truths. And then he said, even as you contemplate these things, be aware that others are doing the same. That as you contemplate aging, as you contemplate infirmity, as you contemplate death, as you contemplate loss, as you contemplate experiencing the consequences of your action, be aware that everybody else who is practicing the Dharma is doing exactly the same thing. And that our awareness of that is interactive, you know, and that especially when it comes to karma, you know, that's interactive. And to the extent that we become sentient about those realities in our own lives, we become equally sentient with regard to others. So if we can see that somebody is clearly in a state of a lot of fear or aversion, then we understand that that's because they're struggling with something that makes them afraid. And Rudy said the things that make us most afraid are the ones that are in those daily recollections. He also said that the mind is when you're born, as you come into being, that the mind has a tendency toward what he called intoxication. And it's what the Tibetans call the fear body, which is to say when you're born into the physical body, The body is hardwired to want to stay young and vibrant, and the body is hardwired to stay healthy, and the body is hardwired to avoid harm at all costs. So he said, as a result of those tendencies that are kind of built in, what happens is that since that's a shared tendency, that since everybody collectively in one's culture or society feels the same thing, you know, when he talks about the intoxication of youth, or the intoxication of health, or the intoxication of invincibility, right? Or the intoxication of no change. We got a real eye full of that and down in the beaches in Florida this last week, you know? These intoxications, right? You know, youth, health, vibrance, invincibility. And he said, furthermore, the cultures we're born into, and it was true in the Buddha's time, just like it's true for us, the cultures we're born into reinforce that view, you know, and they support that view. A great chunks of our economy are focused on reinforcing those views. And so he said, what we're doing when we do this practice is that we are beginning to sober up, essentially. That we're beginning to come to terms with things that are outside of this bubble of illusion. That he basically described it in kind of evolutionary terms. You know, that we may be born into the fear body, the one that is just focused on those things, but that as we mature physically and as we mature spiritually, then we are invited to realize that the intoxications are just that, they're illusory, they're not true. We are going to age. We are going to be subject to infirmity or injury. We are going to die. We are going to suffer loss. And it is the denial of those things that creates the anxiety. It creates the fear. And so this is a radical practice, but he's saying it's kind of like, I sometimes liken the recollections as kind of a vaccination, right? Like a vaccination against fear, and a vaccination against panic, vaccination against despair. Just like the way a vaccine works, is in my very limited understanding of it, is that in a non-life-threatening way, it challenges the body a little bit. It kind of mobilizes the body to strengthen its ability to fight off the very disease that the vaccine has introduced a neutral form of, so that when the real thing comes along, the body is better able to respond in a healthy way to what's going on. And so that's why I use that quite limited analogy. You know, to the extent that we follow this teaching and we do not live in an illusory cultural gloss, where aging doesn't happen and health is always available and we don't even talk about death, you know. Once we're willing to step out of that bubble, once we're willing to say, you know, that's not really true. This is what's really true, you know. So the reason that the recollections can be a little hard to swallow isn't because there's not truth in them. It's because acknowledging the truth of them is a real threat to the self. And so we are gradually, little bit by little bit, building up some immunity to the fears and the anxieties that accompany acknowledgement of death. Is that resonating with people? Is that making sense? Okay. So it's a powerful practice, like any other spiritual practice, like yoga or martial arts or something of that nature. You have to do it mindfully. Like, I prefer not to count the times that I've hurt myself getting a little too carried away with my yoga, trying to look too much like the teacher instead of respecting my limits. And so sometimes doing these practices can have a kind of actually a calming and a clarifying effect. Other times they can arouse a certain amount of anxiety or fear. And so, especially if you're self-aversive like I am, if you start feeling those feelings when you're doing the practice, and you know that those feelings are arising from a sense of self, then you can start to feel guilty for feeling anxious or afraid, right? Like, wow, if I really had my Dharma act together, I'd just be able to blissfully take all this in, and I wouldn't be feeling anxious about it. Well, not really. That's not how it works. And so just respect, as you're doing this practice, respect your limits. And if it feels like, this doesn't feel like the right time to do this practice, then, that's perfectly okay. I remember one time when I was teaching this practice, there was a woman who asked a question, and she is a hospital chaplain. And she said, well, when I'm going in sitting bedside with somebody who's got a chronic and perhaps life-threatening illness, I'm not really so sure this is a teaching I want to lay on. And I couldn't agree with her more. A much better practice in a situation like that, of course, is going to be metta, or helping cultivate self-compassion. So it's a matter of deciding when it makes the most sense to do what practice. So what I think I'd like to do now is to spend just a few minutes talking about the practice of the recollections and the parami, or the refinement of the quality of courage in what we're doing, because that is a quality of mine that it is really fairly crucial to the situation we find ourselves in and to the practice of doing these practices and living the Dharma in general. So I enlisted in the Navy Hospital Corps right out of high school in 1964, and I enlisted in the Navy Hospital Corps because I'd registered for the draft as a non-combatant, and so I wanted to be of service, but I didn't want to be in any way engaged in taking life. And so I did that. I went to boot camp. I was in Navy Hospital Corps school when the Vietnam War broke out big time. And since the Marine Corps is actually part of the Navy, after I finished my training, I got assigned to the Marine Corps. So I was first in San Diego, and then I went overseas to Vietnam. And so I had volunteered to be in the military, but even back then, I didn't believe in the war. I didn't believe we should be there and what we were doing, which was an awkward position to be in because a lot of the Marines felt the other way. When I got to Vietnam, because I had access to medical data, I learned a couple of really interesting things. One was that our casualty rates were much higher than what was being reported in the news. And I note now that a parallel with our current situation is that the stage we don't really have much of an idea of what our contagion level is because there's been so little testing. So we were really in the dark, and medical healthcare professionals acknowledge us every day. So something I learned about the casualty rates also was that the majority of the casualties, both injuries and deaths, occurred either within the first 2 months that a person was in country or within the last 30 days. The ones that happened at the beginning were because there was very little in the way of training that we got stateside before going to Vietnam that was of any use to fighting a jungle war in the in Southeast Asia. We had been well trained to fight the Korean War, which had actually occurred 15 years earlier. So anything you needed to, things that you really needed to learn to stay alive, you learned after you got there, or you didn't, and you didn't come home. And one of the things you learned was that anything could happen at any time. You know, the camps, field camps where I was, were up in the northern end of the country on the border between North and South Vietnam, and we were subject to rocket and mortar attacks. Occasionally, snipers would just haul off and shoot somebody walking across one of our camps. It was dangerous, and it was, you knew every day there was a possibility that that day would be your last. And there were things you could do about it in order to increase the likelihood of your survival, like wearing your helmet and your flak jacket, thinking through any action that you were planning to take before you took it, being highly situationally aware. But beyond that, there was an almost calming sense that I've done everything I can do, and whatever beyond that is going to happen is going to happen. Okay. And it was a mindset that I call it kind of optimistic fatalism. You know, we knew that our chances of getting home alive and in one piece were actually quite good, especially if we did the things that we knew would help those chances. And another name for this optimistic fatalism is nerve. You know, we trusted each other to have nerve to be simultaneously situationally aware and to act in each other's interests, as well as our own, since they were basically the same. And the casualty rates going up again in the last 30 days of a tour of duty were the result of losing your nerve. Marines were sent to Vietnam for a 13-month tour of duty, and it was considered both dangerous and bad luck to start counting days that you had left in country because it placed too much emphasis on the future, when what was needed was an absolute and relentless focus on the present. But in the last 30 days, the countdown becomes inevitable, your last month in country. And the hope begins to arise that going home alive and intact was within grasp. And the greater the hope, the more the loss of nerve. It was worse for those among us who were married, and even more so if they had kids. For that reason, those with only 30 days left were not sent out on combat patrol, since they were a danger both to themselves and to other Marines. So what can we learn from this that's applicable to our situation here? Another word for nerve is courage. And in this regard, both in combat and in practicing the Dharma, courage is, in my experience, not an absence of fear. What courage consists of is a combination of faith and equanimity in the presence of fear. The faith is in yourself, your training, your constancy, your capacity for endurance. The equanimity is the Buddha field that the awakened mind emanates, within which both your faith and your fear exist. So if fear is an emanation of the self, of the fear body, you know, faith and equanimity are emanations of your Buddha nature. Can people speak to me? Are you muted, or can you talk to me if you want?
I think we can talk.
Okay, good. So if anyone wants any clarification on what I just said, I'm happy to chat about that a little bit more. Okay. So courage. And what I learned over there is that essentially courage wasn't optional. courage was something that it was just, that just began to develop almost of its own accord, because it was that highly present moment, you know, what was going on in the field around you, combined.
Lloyd, you're muted.
Am I back up now?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, the courage just kind of grows out of yourself, and it's stimulated by the environment you're in. So, and it's essential, and it's a naturally arising phenomenon. So it just, it's there. It comes to, and it gets stronger the more we find ourselves in situation. Something else in addition to courage is community. Survival and combat depended heavily on the strength and cohesion of the unit you're a part of. Likewise, the strength of Sangha is just as important for helping each other through the times that we find ourselves in. Okay. The challenges also present opportunities for us to come together in multiple different configurations to support each other and to be of service to those in the places where we live that are they're most in need. Something else that I think is pretty important is frontline support. Although the entirety of Vietnam is a combat zone, only about a third of those in country were actually engaged in direct combat activities. The rest were in support bases, mostly along the coastlines, big naval bases and Air Force bases and whatnot. So the real dangerous, grungy work was being done by the people on the front line that the rest were supporting. When I think about our current situation, it seems to me like the people on the front line are healthcare workers, first responders, people who are daily putting themselves in harm's way in order to treat people who are sick. And so I think a lot about, and one of the things that is a sangha that we might start trying to turn our attention to a little bit is there any way that we can be of support to those people? Is there any way that we can offer them what they need? You know, it's, we have a limited ability in terms of personal protective equipment, but there may be other ways that we can be of support. And so turning our attention to that a little bit, I think, is going to be helpful. I think about our healthcare workers and first responders as kind of like the immune system of the body politic. They are the ones that are out there doing what they can to help us stay safe and healthy. And that, you know, I was talking about upping your chances of getting home alive and intact by doing things like wearing your flak jacket and your helmet and hypersense, you know, situational awareness and whatnot. We know that there are things that we can do that are going to increase the likelihood of us staying healthy and helping each other out as well as ourselves. So getting back to this point of physical distancing and social contact, you know, taking it seriously. I being the inveterate catastrophizer that I am, I looked at what the worst case scenario might be for infection rates, and it may, some models have it as high as 50%. And then I looked at what the mortality rate is for people in my particular age group, which is around 8% or so. And so then I kind of multiplied those out and said, it looks like I may be facing somewhat in the neighborhood of the same level of risk as I did in Vietnam. And so that simply becomes part of my lived existence every day. And I actually found looking at the numbers and running through them to be helpful. Just like in Vietnam, you know, there are things that I think all of us can and should be doing, regardless of the age group that we find ourselves in, that'll make it more likely that we stay safe and that will reduce the chances of, even if we're carriers without knowing it, of transmitting it to somebody else. So it's a way for us to remember that we're not just kind of passive, hapless victims of fate, but there are things we can actually do actively to help take care of ourselves. And that being said, I think the vast majority of us are going to come through this relatively unharmed and unscathed and safe. And I have every expectation that that's going to be the case. And for any of us that it turns out that maybe it's not, we need to know about it. We need to know about it so we can figure out all the ways possible for us to be there for each other, even if we can't always be in person. And personally, kind of like Sharon was touching on, I think we're going to come through this stronger and more cohesive and more compassionate and more courageous than we were before this began. So please, questions, comments, discussion. The floor is open.
Lloyd, this is Sharon again.
Hi, Sharon.
It's really nice to be able to hear you speak again. And yeah. And your analogy with Vietnam is beautiful. Very, very thought-provoking, very relevant. I'll be thinking about it for a long time.
Good. I was really having mixed thoughts about whether to do that, but on balance, it seemed to me worthwhile, because what I want, in my case in Vietnam, I was in the military. I was trained for it. I was prepared for it. And a huge difference, of course, is that we're having this thrust upon us. And so we are all being called in some way to be spiritual warriors, to take the warrior stance, to allow our consciousness to develop in such a way as to experience both the I'm having trouble with words. I guess character building is one way to say it. You know, they talk about the World War II generation being the greatest generation, and it's kind of always bothered me a little bit. I think to the extent that generation was great and acted together in a mutually supportive and courageous way, is because of the circumstances that were thrust upon them. And they rose to the challenge and they did very noble things. And I find us to be in exactly the same situation. You know, we have had a situation thrust upon us that really requires us to come forth, you know, because the alternative is to, you know, roll up in a ball under the covers. and there are times when that feels like the only thing that makes sense to do. But generally speaking, instead, I think that we are in some ways psychologically facing many of the same pressures that I did in Vietnam. And I think that one of the things that I didn't realize until long after I got home, because mostly I had really bad memories of being over there, but one of the things that was a characteristic of my daily life while I was there that I didn't really rediscover until I got deeply immersed in the Dharma was the absolute necessity of living in the present moment.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that is ultimately where the peace lies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just being with things as they are in the moment, being situationally aware, being aware of your own state of being and the state of being of people around you. So being in the present moment, acknowledging things as they are, including difficult emotions that might arise. You know, like he said, you know, don't expect the fear to not be there. We're hardwired for it. Yeah. But we have these capabilities as Dharma students that we, you know, whether we realize it or not, we have been cultivating over the entire time that we've been practicing and that we've been studying. So there are ways in which, as Buddha Dharma yogis, we have been in training for this moment. You know, we do in fact have capabilities that we weren't aware that we had. I think, you know, for any of us that have faced tough times in our practice, whatever that was, you know, by working through that, we became stronger, we became more courageous, and we became more capable. And I'm just now coming to understand and to appreciate how much the training that we've been getting through Dharma practice is now there waiting for us to make use of it in a way both to keep ourselves whole and to also help each other.
Yeah. And the your point about being present in the moment, we've been trying to do that for years. this is the absolute ultimate opportunity.
It's
awfully hard not to think a lot through the day, you know, what's going on. I mean, it's very hard to stay in the moment because we're pulled into the future, but there's never been a greater opportunity. So we need to seize the opportunity to grow.
Yes, thank you. When I look at the do kind of a content analysis of my day, I'm a little embarrassed to acknowledge how much of it I think is basically unwholesome activity, which is to say the obsessive going from one news site to another, and then back to the first one and looking for any new little bit of information. And also, of course, reading all the opinions that agree with mine. And it's like, at some point, you know, I don't really think that's such a good idea. I don't find it being helpful for me or helping me to maintain my balance. One idea that has come to mind for me that we may want to kick around is that there are several people in our Sangha who are deeply experienced and well-trained in areas like medicine and public health and social services. And so I'm thinking that it might be useful if we were to put together maybe some kind of little annotated bibliography of sites that you can visit where you are more likely than not to get reliable, up-to-date, reasonably presented information. Because so much of the noise that's out there in the news media right now is just terribly confusing, and you can tell that it's really, there's an undercurrent of anxiety and fear and whatnot, because that's of course how the news media make their living. You know, you must read this. This is threatening your, you know, your Maslowian needs hierarchy way down at the base. And so you must read this story. You must read the next story. When in fact, aside from just, you know, quickly checking the what's coming up on the headlines, you know, I heard this joke once recently about the reason that we have such toilet paper shortage is that people keep checking their 401ks. You know, it's like, enough already. You know, what's going to happen is going to happen. So, not let ourselves become needlessly anxious through our news media diet, I guess is what I was going to say.
Oh, definitely. I'm a physician, and I've advised all my friends on a few trusted resources, and I just don't basically pay attention to the others. It's as simple as this: the CDC and the State Health Department. I happen to have a friend who has a epidemiologist friend who was at the CDC, who is now in LA, who puts out personal bulletins, and I've shared that with people, and it's very factual. It's nothing but the facts. So those are the only three places I'm getting my information, and I don't know how people would contact me, but if you would like Faith's almost daily update, I'll be happy to forward it on to you when I get it from my friend.
I think so. I think that would be a good idea. And maybe if you were to send those suggestions you may have to maybe either Kathleen or me or maybe Ken, then we can come up with a list that we can then share with the Sangha as a whole. And if there are others who likewise have sites you like to go to that you trust, that you think are really going to be helpful in terms of providing, you know, reliable information that's not tinged in one way or another, I think that would be great. You know, it's, I think it's one of the ways we could help each other out. Thank you.
Oh, and to reduce anxiety, there are lots of things we can do. And reading misinformation, we shouldn't be doing that. So I'm glad you brought that up, because it's another way we can help ourselves.
Exactly. Good. Thank you. Okay. Anything else to share?
I had sort of an observation.
And is this Joe?
Yeah, this is Joe. Hi, Joe. So you had talked about Vietnam, and I, it was interesting for me because I watched the Ken Burns series, I think it was last summer. And for me, that wasn't in my generation, but it was unbelievable to me just how big that was and how many people were a part of it.
Yes.
And so to hear you kind of talk about some of the dynamics in the field, and I know you were in the field, and there were a lot of things you saw and you were part of. I appreciate you sharing that part of it. But one of the things I wanted to talk about was the issue of hope. And it's something I talk to my clients about. And it's a very hard issue to talk about. I try and be very practical about, you had said hope could be, hope in that case could be dangerous. And one of the things that I talk to people about is, you know, sometimes when we're confronted with something that's really threatening in our lives, we have this hope that we're not going to have to sort of confront it, or that it's not going to be as hard as we think it might be. And
yes,
we have this fear that at some point we will have to confront it. And so we kind of vacillate between the hope and the fear, and sometimes it kind of really paralyzes us.
Yes.
And so I just kind of wanted to ask you, because for me as a counselor, you know, so many people are talking about anxiety and fear, and I really think that it's so much more than that. You know, it's not just simply an emotion. It's not just simply kind of like these sort of thoughts in our head, but it's a very sort of deep kind of primal response.
Thank you.
And so I wanted to ask you, like, how do you talk to people at this point in time who are filled with so much fear, and kind of talk about sort of how, you know, like you were saying, there are real life situations where it's kind of necessary that we all have a certain amount of courage that we display, and it's kind of important for everyone that we kind of try and do that, that we
yeah.
can do that for each other to sort of get through this. So how do you talk to people who, you know, they want to hold on to a certain sort of hope, or they, you know, or they don't really want to talk because they're so afraid?
Yeah.
What would you recommend?
Thank you, Joe. I really, you know, these are really rich thoughts, and I kind of sit with them a lot. I guess in the specific context of Vietnam and combat, what turned out to be the most useful state of mind in that situation from the standpoint of survival, or the likelihood of surviving, was to not be fixated every day on whether or not I'm going to get out of here alive at the end of my tour. It was much more about, what am I going to do today to make it more likely that I might get out of here alive. So, so for instance, for people in a therapeutic context, I'd say it's tricky if you say, well, you shouldn't have any hope that you're going to get better, you know, or that doing this therapy is going to be a benefit to you. I think it's absolutely essential, you know, whether it's the therapeutic context or the practice of the Dharma or anything else. I think it's really important that there be a positive vision of your goal, you know.
Right.
I think where it gets tricky is this, well, I really, really hope that things get better and that I don't keep suffering the way that I am. But when that kind of hope is coming from a more passive place, mm-hmm. as if you don't have an active role to play and whether or not your positive vision is attainable, mm-hmm. I think that's when it can be a little problematic, you know, because what happens in that case, the people in Vietnam, is that the hope and fear became intertwined, okay? So you're not so overtaken with fear when all you're really doing is doing everything possible to make it look more likely than not than you're going to make it through this day. And if you string enough of those days together, then, you know, you might get out of here alive. But what would happen toward the end is people would start to say, Jesus, I might actually get out of here. And they start focusing more on the future than they are in the present. And that's what makes them dangerous and unstable. And what leads to the fear kind of causing them to contract and lose their timing, lose their situational awareness, because part of the mind is already fixated on the future when it all needs to be right in the present. So I'd say it's really important to have a vision for a wholesome outcome.
Right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of what brought me to this question was, you know, talking to so many counselors this week, you know, the first thing that happened for so many counselors is their clients just canceled their sessions.
Yes.
They just sort of dropped their therapist, and you sort of think, like, that's what you need right now. But, you know, for so many people, that was sort of the gut reaction was, you know, the fear just became paralyzing.
Yes. Right. And I think that one of the ways that we as Dharma practitioners can be of the greatest benefit to others is if we hear people speaking out of that state of mind, then what I didn't find to be so helpful was to say, oh, well, don't be afraid. Well, probably it really starts with acknowledging exactly what the truth of their state of being in the moment is, and just listening carefully to it, and then saying stuff like, well, you know, sometimes I'm afraid too, and then you can say what your other thought processes are, you know, how you find it helpful to just, you know, reside in the moment rather than getting carried away with thoughts of the future, and having faith in both in oneself and in each other, you know, that there are many more reasons to be hopeful in that positive sense, whether it's for one's own well-being or our well-being as a society, which are, of course, interconnected. Without preaching, but just, you know, acknowledging where, you know, here I am talking to a therapist about how to be with somebody in trouble, which is a little presumptuous, being with others, acknowledging that their feelings are oftentimes yours as well, and, you know, and we'll make it through.
Yeah. All right. Awesome.
Jim, can I just mention that I got an email from my therapist who basically is only doing Zoom now, and I have three risk factors, and I had decided that even though she was trying to sanitize the door handles, she has a lot of people through her house, and I think it came primarily from her fear of having so many people in her house. But I, you know, a lot of doctor's offices are going to telemedicine. I don't think it's overkill by any means to do whatever you can regarding appointments, either over the phone for Zoom. I think that's warranted.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. That's what I'm doing. Yeah.
Anything we can do to counter this feeling that, or this understanding that social distancing means social isolation. You know, social isolation is a really, really dangerous state of mind, both because of the mental downward spiral and because of the proven effect of that state of mind in suppressing the immune system, you know? This is a time to totally be there for each other. Well, we're coming up on it, everybody. Keep your eye on your email, because there's going to be a lot of interesting news coming down the pike in the next few days or weeks with regard to new opportunities for us to be in touch and interact with each other with regard to the Dharma and continued Sangha building. And then also, if you have any suggestions for reliable sites to visit with regard to, you know, information and reasoned discourse, by all means, and we'll be in touch as soon as you hear about, you know, our Tuesday morning sits. I warmly invite you to join us for those whenever you can. All right, so let's get back on our sitting posture if we can for just a minute. And allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Buddha Nubhavena Sala Soti Bhavantu Te. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata sava dhamma nuvavena sala sote bhavantu te. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha nuvavena sala soti bhavantu te. By the power of all the sanghas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Good night, everyone. Be well. See you soon.
Good night. Good night.